Although the state of São Paulo is larger than the entire United Kingdom, they were able to get to distant parts of it in time to gather fresh evidence on a number of cases, especially those of poltergeist activity. Suzano is only about an hour's drive from São Paulo, and the IBPP was able to follow this case to its conclusion. On at least three occasions, phenomena took place in their presence, on two of which they were recorded on tape. The Suzano story began with a bang. It was just after midday on May 22, 1970. Nobody was in the house at the time, and 15-year-old Irene was washing clothes in a neighbor's house when a loud explosion was heard, coming from her home. Smoke began to seep through the tiles of the roof, and neighbors rushed in to find that fire had broken out inside a wardrobe, burning holes in several pieces of clothing. The fire was easily put out, but at 5 o'clock the same afternoon bedclothes in the same room caught fire on each of the two beds. Again, there was nobody around at the time, Irene being 20 yards away outside the house. Within an hour, clothing that had been rescued from the first fire and dumped in the outside bathroom caught fire again, although it was still soaking wet. Later that night, Jeziel, the owner of the house, was roused by screams and yells from the room where his four children were sleeping. A fireball, they told him, had come down and set fire to one of their mattresses. Unable to put the fire out, they dragged the mattress into the yard, where it was completely destroyed. 10 minutes later, the sofa in the living room caught fire. Water was thrown on it and the fire extinguished, but after it also had been dragged out into the yard, it too caught fire again, although saturated with water, this time burning itself completely out. At this point, a police patrol happened to pass by, stopping their car to see what all the fuss was about. Once they were satisfied that nothing illegal seemed to be going on, the policeman offered to help, while one of them put through a call to headquarters to report the incident. At the police station, the chief officer felt uncomfortable. Only a few days earlier he had received an official complaint from Jeziel that stones had been thrown through his window and even through the roof, breaking several tiles. The officer had thought little of the incidents at the time, but now he decided to have a look for himself, taking his forensic expert Natal de Lima along with him. While waiting for their chief to arrive, one of the policemen picked up a calendar from the floor and hung it on a nail on the bedroom wall. After a few minutes it blackened and burst into flames. It was, he later testified, a bluish flame like that of a gas burner, and when he put his finger in it, he burned it as he would have done in a normal flame. At that moment the chief arrived, and after hearing what had been going on he took a sheet of newspaper and hung it from a nail in the living room wall. This duly caught fire right in front of his eyes, leaving a burn mark on the wall behind it, although it was damp when picked up from the floor. The following day, another minor fire broke out in a kitchen cabinet, and 5 days later there were two more, one in the main bedroom, the baby's cradle, which had already been attacked, and the other in the children's room, where a bed lent by neighbors to replace the one that had been destroyed earlier also caught fire. On both these occasions nobody was in the house at the time. The children had been moved to a house nearby for their safety. This made a total of 10 cases of paranormal spontaneous combustion, at least one of which had been personally witnessed by a police commissioner. All phenomena ceased when Irene was sent away to stay with an aunt for a few days, at the suggestion of a local priest, whom the girl's mother had asked to come and exorcise the house. The priest refused to do this, so yet again the spiritists were called in as a last resort. Nobody concerned was prepared to give researchers much information about this episode, except that the family had contacted no less than a captain in the military police, a spiritist, who had taken them to a center. Here, the spirit supposed to have been provoking the trouble was identified and appeased. Again, the method seemed to work, as in the Rue Agassiz case, and no more poltergeist activity was reported, although the family left Suzano shortly afterwards. Probing into the family's history, researchers found that Irene had good reason to be highly strung and emotionally upset. She had a very strong personality to start with, and she did not get along with her father, who often beat her. some years previously. The father had left home to live with another woman, and to make matters worse, he was unable to get regular work because of defective eyesight. Altogether, it was not the happiest of families, as so often in poltergeist cases, and it seemed likely that the sensitive and frustrated Irene was somehow providing the energy needed by the unseen home wrecker. In February 1975, I went to Susana to interview Natal de Lima, one of the policemen who had been at the house when the phenomena started. It is not often that poltergeist cases are witnessed by police officers, and we thought that he, the station's forensic expert, might be able to give us more precise evidence than you usually get from confused and frightened witnesses of such cases. We were right. Natal de Lima not only remembered the events of 1970 very clearly, but told me that it had been the most memorable experience of his 20-year career, during which had witnessed a wide variety of criminal activity, including several murders and suicides. He had, as I soon found, a good eye for detail. I began by asking him about the fires he claimed to have seen breaking out. "We were looking at the mattress," he replied, "and it had started to burn inside. Smoke was seeping out." "All over?" I asked, "or just from one of two places?" "No, it was coming from the middle of the mattress, slowly, just like something that's catching fire normally. But the fire came from inside. That is inexplicable by physics or chemistry or anything else." "Only it came from underneath," I suggested. I was quite enjoying grilling somebody who normally asks the questions. "No," he insisted. We turned the mattress over and looked. Nothing. That fire started inside the mattress. Then Jeziel said he'd cut it open as he could sew it up later. So he did, and it was burning inside. The cotton stuffing, he added, was glowing like hot coals, but not producing a flame. Next, I asked de Lima to confirm that he had seen a stone apparently materialize inside the house. Our dialogue went like this. I began by asking, "The stone came into the room without breaking a tile?" "Yes." "But how?" "Through the window?" "No, because the window was closed." "So it seems the stone went through the roof?" "Yes, through the roof. I can guarantee to you that there was no possibility of that stone to appear unless somebody had come in and thrown it. But there wasn't anybody there." Natal de Lima described several other instances in which he had witnessed fires starting by themselves, and stones being thrown inside the house when everybody in the room was in full view. This was valuable testimony from a professional observer for two of the most controversial items in the poltergeist's repertoire. He also confirmed to me that the troubles seemed to have ended following the intervention of a group of local spiritists that included the military police officer already mentioned. According to them, the chief suspect for cause of the trouble was Jeziel's jealous ex-mistress. We were not able to follow up this lead, but we were not surprised to hear that, as so often in Brazil, there seemed to be a close connection between poltergeist phenomena and black magic practices. 1. So much for haunted houses for the time being. Now the haunted car. Brasilia, showplace of some of Brazil's finest city planning and architecture, was inaugurated as the country's federal capital on April 21, 1960, after a dream of more than a century had been made to come true by the determination and foresight of President Juscelino Kubitschek. It is a spectacularly contemporary city, lying 3,000 feet above sea level, some 600 miles from Rio de Janeiro, on a gently sloping plateau almost entirely devoid of vegetation more than a few feet high. The whole city was built from scratch in 5 years, soon becoming a metropolis with a steadily growing population and not a sign of the past. Not a visible sign, that is. For within 5 months of the inauguration ceremony, the city of the future had produced its first poltergeist. To be precise, it was some 22 miles from the city center, though well within the borders of the new federal district. 6 men and women were driving along the main road towards Belo Horizonte on the moonless night of September 18, 1960. The party consisted of a young couple, married that very day in the nearby town of Luisania, the bridegroom's parents, the driver, and one of Brazil's most distinguished doctors, Dr. Oliver Trindade, who attracted international attention with his discovery of new methods of treating meningitis. The countryside around Brasilia is among the country's bleakest, with not a house and scarcely a stunted tree in sight. It was about midnight, Dr. Trindade recalls, when he and his friends were bowling along the road not far from Brasilia's sedate Leiva suburb, when the car, a Willys station wagon, began to show signs of overheating. They stopped, finding everything in order under the bonnet. Then, all at once, stones began to be flung at them from the silent darkness around. One stone the size of a saucer landed in Dr. Trindade's lap after hitting both the bride and her mother-in-law on their heads. The driver, who was outside the car, drew his gun and fired four shots without seeming to affect the mysterious bombardment in the slightest. Knowing there was a police post within 2 miles, the party decided to go there at once and ask for help. Dr. Trindade had managed to save 2 stones, which he showed to the startled policeman at the post. One of these offered to come and examine the scene of the event, so 3 of the party stayed behind at the post while he climbed into the back of the car, heavily armed. Back at the original spot, Dr. Trindade, who was unarmed, stayed inside the car as the others climbed out. The moment they did so, the stoning began again. The driver drew his gun and tried to fire, but found it had jammed. A stone hit him on the arm, and another caught him on the head, drawing blood from a cut on the scalp. Stones continued to fly from all directions, crashing against the car and occasionally against people, although the car's headlights revealed no trace of incarnate life whichever way they were turned. There seemed nothing more to be done, so they all went back to the police checkpoint for a welcome cup of coffee. While this was being brewed, a shower of gravel and sand fell on the chair where Dr. Trindade had left his original pair of stones. Back on the road, the bombardment began for the 3rd time. Gusts of sand blew into the car's interior, although all windows were tightly closed except for a small gap in the front, while occasional metallic thuds showed that the car was still under intermittent attack. And there was worse to come. The driver had handed over the wheel to the bridegroom and was sitting in the right-hand passenger seat up front. Suddenly he let out a yell and cried that somebody was trying to open the door. Dr. Trindade leaned forward and grabbed the door, helping the driver keep it in position. Even so, he recalls, I could feel it gradually opening, by a terrible force. I gathered all my muscular strength together, and finally managed to hold it shut, and I shouted at the driver to lock the handle. But the handle unlocked itself of its own accord and the door began to open again. This happened several times. Once, the driver thought he saw a vague form outside the window, and aimed his gun at it, but the gun was still jammed. By this time we were all scared stiff. I thought the driver would be dragged outside if that door opened. Dr. Trindade's fingers became so sore that he could no longer hold on to the mysteriously controlled door, so he changed places with the bridegroom's father and let him take a turn at trying to keep the intruder out. The father, convinced that an evil spirit was at work, told everybody to start praying, they were all Catholics, and asked that the cause of such affliction should return to the kingdom of glory and leave everybody in peace. An awesome silence reigned, said Dr. Trindade, broken only by the sound of praying out loud and the stones echoing in the nocturnal solitude of the immense Goiás plateau. The prayer seemed to have some effect, and the pressure on the door eased. It was about then that the bridegroom's father noticed that the glass had come off his wristwatch and was wedged between his fingers. They finally reached their hotel in Cidade Leiva at 2 o'clock in the morning. The first thing the driver did was fire his gun, finding that it worked perfectly. The honeymoon couple went off to bed, taking the damaged wristwatch with them, noticing that the metal wristband had been stretched out of its normal position. They left the watch on a table, placing the glass beside it. The following morning, the glass was back in place and the wristband had returned to its normal shape. There was no sign of even a scratch on the paintwork of the Willys station wagon. Leaving the honeymoon couple to the peace and quiet, Under normal circumstances, of the Goiás Plateau, Dr. Trindade and his friends returned to their homes in São Paulo. At once, the conscientious doctor drew up a statement, which all four of them signed the following day. "We never thought we would witness such unexpected events in such an undeniably evident manner," the statement ended. "Yet the reality of the facts imposes itself upon our former incredulity. A feature common to most poltergeist cases is that some specific person, often but not always a teenager, seems to be around whenever things start happening. This leads researchers to regard that person as the chief suspect, which can be very embarrassing when the case concerns a family whose confidence they may have taken great pains to win. It is not easy to have to face somebody who has invited you into their home, let you stay the night and turn the whole place upside down with your equipment, and spend hours dictating testimony into your tape recorder, only to have to tell them that you think they may be doing it all, or at least some of it, on purpose. You feel especially uncomfortable if something then happens that suggests your chief suspect is innocent. This is what happened during the first case in which I was able to meet a poltergeist in person, if that is the word. The case, which took place in the São Paulo suburb of Ipiranga, was of such bewildering complexity that I can only give a bare outline of it here. I must confess that I had always considered poltergeists to be slightly comic. I hope neither I nor anyone else has such a thought again. A really persistent one. This one went on for more than 6 years, can drive an innocent family to desperation and even to attempted suicide. The Ipiranga case had quite a history. It had begun in 1968, and continued ever since then, although the family had moved house no less than 3 times in an attempt to shake off the trouble. This seemed to show that poltergeist activity was person-directed, rather than placer-directed, as in the Paraguay case. It also suggested that if fraud was at work, the family itself was unable to detect it in 6 years. A brief glance at the evidence also showed that any of the 3 women in the family could be regarded as the epicenter of the phenomena, or alternatively as the chief suspect. The family involved consisted of a mother, her daughter Irasi, one of her 2 sons, and his wife Nora. Irasi, our main source of information about the case, was the family's main breadwinner. In her early 20s, attractive and intelligent, she had a well-paid job in the São Paulo office of a multinational company, and struck us as someone of strong character with a realistic approach to life, including the phenomena that had been part of her own life for nearly a quarter of it. Her mother was a calm and amiable woman of Portuguese descent who had separated from her husband long before the troubles began. Her 2 brothers were, it seemed, the black sheep of the family. One was in prison, we didn't ask why, and the other was thought to be a drug dealer. We only met him once as he seemed to spend most of his time traveling, and he struck us as a very sinister individual. His wife Nora looked at first like the perfect epicenter for a poltergeist case. Like her mother-in-law, she was quiet and friendly, but was also clearly in an advanced state of neurosis. Perhaps because she had no children after 6 years of marriage, and seemed unable to hold down a regular job. The first incident, which took place in 1968, was right out of the Black Magic textbook. A despacho, literally, dispatch or offering, of bottles, candles and cigars appeared one day in the garden of their original house, indicating that somebody was doing a trabalho, hex, against the family, though nobody could imagine who, or why. Then another, lit, candle appeared, this time inside the house, where it set fire to a curtain. After this disturbing incident, Nora became violently possessed, spending days and nights in bed muttering in a strange voice and finally trying to jump out of a top-floor window. She was taken to hospital, but escaped and found her way home. She was never able to explain how, and by the time we met her she could remember nothing of the whole episode, though Irasi remembered it well. The family then moved house, but this seemed to have no effect at all on the poltergeist, which soon produced nearly every trick in its book of ways of driving people crazy. Bangs and crashes were heard at night, furniture was thrown around, clothing and bedding had caught fire or been soaked with water, or both. Objects would disappear and reappear with such regularity that it became almost a family joke. Irasi's prized collection of woolly animals was especially popular with her unseen enemy. One of them appeared on the roof of the house, another turned up in the middle of a busy street intersection outside the house, and when Irasi managed to retrieve it, with some difficulty and at the risk of being run over, she got home to find another animal missing. Looking out of the window, she saw it in the middle of the same intersection. This sort of thing happened so often that Irasi finally dumped her entire collection of animals in a river. She had come to suspect that some kind of evil was at work, and rivers are thought to be the best place to dispose of objects affected by black magic practices. In the third house, where the family spent only 1 month in 1971, loud knocks were heard on the front door that they were sure could not have been made by anybody visible. Nora's husband's pajamas caught fire while he was asleep in them, and finally the house, which was brand new, set itself on fire when there was nobody at home. Mother and Nora came back from shopping to find the house full of smoke. The fire had started in a bedroom and destroyed two wardrobes and an entire bed, mattress, wooden frame, sheets and all. An interesting feature of paranormal spontaneous combustion, PSC, is that it comes in two forms. Sometimes it will be no more than a brief outbreak, and will put itself out without causing serious damage. At other times it will completely destroy the object in question. The interesting feature of the former variety, which is hard to explain in terms of presently understood physics, is that objects that are highly inflammable will not burn themselves out. If some hoaxer was applying matches to items of clothing or bedclothes, these would either go up in flames at once, or in the case of some fabrics, crinkle up and melt. Like many schoolboys of my generation, I learned how to start a fire with the aid of a magnifying glass and the sun. By holding the glass still, the sun was focused on a piece of paper or whatever, which would gradually darken, then smolder and finally burst into normal flames. It often looks as though poltergeists do something similar. PSC burn marks are often small round holes, as if made by a poker, and as often as not they remain small, as if the necessary energy was not available for them to spread and destroy the target object completely. Such outbreaks of fire, along with just about everything else from the poltergeist's box of tricks, became far worse in the fourth home to be attacked by the Ipirongo invader. After ruining Irasi's entire wardrobe, it began to work its destructive way through the replacement items she kept having to buy. One morning, when she was in the bathroom, her handbag caught fire inside, totally destroying her paper money and documents. Almost every day, somebody lost something or other and had to search the house for it. Kitchen knives would disappear, then turn up neatly arranged in a flower vase. Clothes and shoes would move themselves from bedroom to staircase or living room. Small objects would hide themselves under beds. Somebody's identity card vanished and turned up inside a kitchen drawer that was very hard to open. One day, bedclothes literally tied themselves in knots. Normal life became impossible, and Irasi began to feel the strain. The whole family was suffering, but she seemed to be the main target. One day she received a phone call in her office, just after her extension had been changed, telling her that her married sister in Rio de Janeiro had been taken seriously ill. A friend offered to drive her there at once, but had a serious accident, his first ever, on his way to pick her up. Irasi and her mother finally got to Rio by bus only to find the sister alive and well and wondering what all the fuss was about. Two or three similar incidents involving phone false alarms took place, and Irasi even hired a private detective to track down the mystery caller, but without success. Worst of all, however, were the dispacos, which kept coming in a variety of forms. One day, four passport-sized photos of Irasi appeared on the living room floor, folded and sewn up with thread. Each photo had been taken in a different year, and Irasi could not recall where they had been kept. Then it was the Patu A tilde inverted exclamation mark S. These are small leather pouches closed by pulling a thread around the top, popular with Brazilians for keeping things like coins or buttons in. These began to turn up all over the place, even out of doors. One made its way into Iras's bed and was found to contain a live cockroach. Another fell out of Nora's dress in full view of her aunt, one of several relatives and friends who gave us supporting testimony on this case. When they did not contain live insects, they would contain disfigured photos of Nora's husband, or brief messages telling him that Nora was running around with another man. This she vehemently denied, and there was never any evidence that she was. Altogether, it was clear that somebody, or something, was trying to drive the whole family out of its mind. But who? There were two possible deceased suspects, an ex-boyfriend of Iras's who had committed suicide, and an elderly aunt who had died somewhat neglected by the rest of the family and might have borne a grudge against them for abandoning her. There was also a possible suspect from the land of the living. Irasi, we learned, had had a brief affair with a man who, unknown to her, was already married. Had his wife learned of this, she might well have gone to a Quimbanda center and ordered a trabalho. Then there was the possibility that this was a case of a trabalho rebounding on the person who had originally ordered it, whoever that may have been. Perhaps it was just as well that we did not know all this background until after we had been to the house and got to know the family. All we knew to begin with was that there was a poltergeist disturbance in a house in Ipiranga, and the family involved wanted help. So IBPP research director Suzuka Hashizume and I went along to see what was going on and what if anything we could do about it. We had no idea what to expect. Suzuka decided to take the first night's vigil herself. She arrived at the modest house, a 20-minute taxi ride from her own home in the center of São Paulo, at 9:35 on the rainy evening of October 18, 1973. As soon as she stepped through the door, she was greeted by Irasi with the news that she had only just missed the latest happening. "Wait a minute," said Suzuko, "I'll go and put my umbrella in the bathroom." She went through the kitchen into the house's only bathroom, left her open umbrella there to drip on the floor, and hung her raincoat on the back of one of the kitchen chairs. Mother had just folded Antonio's bedclothes, pajamas, sheets and blankets, Irasi began. Antonio was her fiancé, who had taken to sleeping on the downstairs room's sofa lately at the request of the family, since Nora's husband was away and they felt safer with a man in the house. "Then she came down to cook my dinner," she went on, "and suddenly we heard a noise upstairs. We went up to see what had happened, because whenever we hear a noise we always go up and see that everything is where it should be and nothing has caught fire." She spoke in a matter-of-fact tone, as if it were quite normal for things to be out of place or to catch fire. In that house, it was. "Well," she continued, "when we got upstairs, Mother asked if I had already taken Antonio's things downstairs. I said I hadn't, and she said she had left them on the clothes basket. So we started looking for them, and they turned up on the upstairs balcony. It was raining, and they were all soaking wet." The interesting part of the story was that Nora had almost certainly been out of the house at the time the clothing was moved. She came home at 10:25 and immediately offered some of her own bedclothes to Suzuko, who had been intending to use Antonio's. The women had a cup of tea, Nora and Irasi going up to bed at 11, while Suzuko settled down to watch TV after spreading her card alphabet on the floor in case the poltergeist would like to send a message across the ether. She sat through a film, and by 12:30 a.m. was on the verge of dropping off to sleep, for she had worked her usual full day at the office and was very tired. At that moment, loud bangs from upstairs shook her into full wakefulness. Instantly, she switched on her recorder, only to find that it would not work. Kicking herself for not having tested it beforehand, she took it apart and found one of the batteries had been inserted back to front, a thing she could not recall ever having happened before. 15 minutes later, with the recorder working normally, there were more thumps, followed at two further 15-minute intervals by more outbursts, including one that sounded like hand clapping. It is normal for Brazilians to clap hands when calling on houses that have no bells, but not at that hour. So Zico managed to get to sleep at about 3:15, waking up 3 hours later when mother began to make breakfast in the kitchen next door. The first thing mother found when she opened one of the kitchen cupboards was Suzuko's raincoat, neatly folded inside it.